just to talk for a couple of minutes about let's look up about Jigenpachi, since this is his birthday that we're celebrating. It always falls around Christmas, and it usually coincides with Hanukkah. So there's definitely something about the season of light, you know, in the heart of winter when we just had the equinox, and you know, now the days are going to get longer. So Lama Tsongkhapa lived late 14th, early 15th century in Tibet. He was born in Ando, which is in the eastern part of Tibet. And I was there in 1993. And a quite remarkable place. There's, I can't remember the story exactly. Do you remember that when he was born, they buried the fetus and then a tree grew out of it? Yeah, and there's some thing that, anyway, you can go where the tree is, and then there's, you know, letters on Ma Hong and so forth, kind of in the bark in the tree and in the leaves of the tree. So that's the place where he was born. And he was quite inquisitive, and you know, it's interesting how his tradition has evolved, you know, it eventually became known as the Gelugpa tradition. But Jigenpachi himself was completely non-sectarian. He studied with Nyingma masters, Sakya masters, Kagyu masters, you know, the Kadampa masters. He studied with everybody because he really wanted to learn. Yeah. And so he went to Central Tibet, you know, studied with quite a number of teachers there. And he attended a lot of the debating sessions that they used to have because he had quite a keen mind and really wanted to fathom the depth of the teachings, and so he used debate and reason as a way to really go deeply in order to be able to see actually how things exist and how they don't exist. He never, of course, intended to start a major tradition within Tibetan Buddhism. I don't think any great spiritual leader ever has the intention to start a movement. They just teach what they do. He was both a scholar and a practitioner, you know, both things put into one, which is a rare combination, because sometimes you meet people who are very scholarly, but they don't really know how to practice so well, or other times you meet people who practice a lot, but they don't have the study behind them, and as a result, they can't really explain in words to the disciples so much that they realized. But Jigenpachi had a very unique combination of the two things. He also had a direct line to Manjushri. So it started out, he used to ask one of his lamas to ask questions to Manjushri for him, and then finally he got a direct line himself. So he used to have visions of Manjushri and ask him all of his questions. And these were usually questions like, you know, about the ultimate nature of reality. It wasn't, you know, kind of, you know, I'm sad today, what do I do? You know, it was really like, how do things exist? And at one point, Manjushri sent him off to do some more practice because he needed to do more purification and more accumulation of positive potential in order to fertilize and purify his mind so he can gain realization. So he went to this one place called Oka, which I had the fortune to visit in 1987. Into that. We went there on horses. And he made, you know, the 35 Buddha practice that we do. He made 100,000 prostrations to each of the 35 Buddhas. Okay, so not just 100,000 prostrations to the 35 Buddhas, but 100,000 to each, so that's 3.5 million. And they said that, you know, as he was doing them, he had a vision of the Buddhas, and actually the way that the prayer, you know, used to be, you know how now we say to the one that's gone, da 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 da, to the one that's gone. Initially, the sutra, it actually didn't have that thing, to the one that's gone. It just had the name of that particular Buddha. So he was just reciting that actual name. And so partly through the practice, he had a vision of all the 35 Buddhas, but he couldn't get their heads. You know, they couldn't go out heads. So then he decided he needed to redo it. And so then he started saying, to the one that's gone, the Tathagata. So-and-so, to the one that's gone, da-da. And after that, he had a vision of all of the 35 Buddhas, complete, you know, the heads, everything. You know? And when you go, he, you know, was doing his prostrations, his 3.5 million prostrations, and, you know, they didn't have these nice, comfortable boards nowadays, and, you know, kind of, you know how you do, you know, I mean, your cushion for your knees, and your cushion for your head, and your blanket. You know how it takes you 5 minutes or 10 minutes to lay out everything so that you can be totally comfortable while you're doing your few prostrations. Well, he didn't do it that way. There was just a rock, okay? And he did his prostrations on the rock. And as a result, you can see the imprint of his body on the rock where he did his 3.5 million prostrations. You know, I saw this. And also at Okat, when he did 100,000 mandala offerings, and again, you know, not a nice, pretty plate, you know, like we have. It's very smooth and everything. He just used a stone. And, he, you know, when you do it, you have to rub your forearm 3 times clockwise and 3 times counterclockwise. And he did so much that, of course, his skin here actually started to bleed. But the stone where he made his mandala offerings on it, and again, I saw this too, it has self-arisen flowers and different things on it, you know, syllables and flowers and decorations and ornaments and stuff. And they say that, you know, in Tibet there's several of these kind of self-arisen things when a great practitioner comes to practice in a certain place. So that's, you know, where he did his mandala offerings. And then near Oka there is a place where he made, I forget how many, probably at least 100,000. I think it was Amitaya Satsas, those small satsas that we make. Amitaya is for young life. So we went there as well. And then we also went to Reti, which was, you know, way out. That was an interesting trip getting to Reti. you know, hitchhiking and riding animals and all sorts of different things. Anyway, we got there. And it's the place where he began to compose the Lamrim Chimna, which is one of his great texts, one that really loved so much. And so he's able to go to the place where, you know, they say he actually started writing it. And it was outside, there was just a rock there and some trees around and something. But, you know, when you're at that place where you really, when you think of how much someone's teachings have benefited you, and not just benefit, but completely transformed your whole life, and not just transform this life, but transform many, many lives, because, you know, you study and practice something like that this life, it influences so many future lives. You know, incredible feeling of gratitude to Jirin Bichekeng. And the day we were there, there happened to be some government officials. So, I don't know if that's good or bad, you know, because, of course, the people at the monastery had to be on their best behavior if the government officials were there. But at the same time, they took the government officials way, way up on the mountain, and we were invited to come along with them. And so it was above the place, above Rating, in the place where he started to write the Lamrim Tongue. It was above the mountain, and then way around the side of the mountain, way up in the top, and there was this big boulder field. And before we went there, they told us it was a big boulder field, and in the rocks, you would find the letters Om Ah Hum, but also a lot of Ahs, you know. And because they said that that's where Jay Rinpoche meditated on emptiness, and Ah is the syllable that represents emptiness. So they said that the Ahs fell from the sky when he was meditating on emptiness and landed in the stones. So, you know, ye who have such great faith, you know, goes, yeah, okay, you know, we'll go see. you know, I mean, because, I don't know. Well, anyway, there really were Oms, Ahs, and Hums in those rocks. And it wasn't stuff that was carved in either. It was really in the, you know how the rock has different filaments, or I don't know what it is, what you call it in rocks, you know? But there it really was. I saw many of them, especially Ahs, in the rocks. Not carved, but actually the, the veins in the rock, you know, made the shape of the letters. It's quite remarkable. You had to climb way up across to get there. But Jay Rinpoche was, what he gave, what he bequeathed to us is something really rather, so remarkable, you know, because Lama Tisha had begun systematizing the teachings, you know, when he wrote The Lamp and the Path, and spoke about the three levels of practitioner and all. But Jay Rinpoche really unpacked that further and, you know, really got the Lamrim quite well organized. And the text is been translated into English now. It's three volumes. How he wrote that without a computer where you could go back and edit it, I don't know. You know, I could only imagine being the student, being the scribe who wrote it, and then, you know, having to go back and rewrite things. But it's a tremendous work that really tells how to practice from the very beginning of the path to the very end, you know. And he starts telling you about how to set up your altar, you know, very beginning thing, how to set up an altar, and how to sweep your room, and things like that, all the way up to, you know, the Lakthong, the special insight of the Vipassana section. And then he wrote the Nagarin Tempo, which is the great treatise on the stages of Tantra. Okay, so the Lamrim Tempo deals with the sutra path, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom, and then the gradual Tantra path dealt with the four classes of Tantra, how you know, practice all the different Tantras. So his works, I think, are in 18 volumes. Okay, how do you do that? When you think about that, you know, when you're writing so much and then the way they print it, you had to carve all the letters backwards into a piece of wood because they would print everything, you know, on these rice paper. And it's truly remarkable. Somebody could write so much and, you know, then have it printed. But some of his great contributions, you know, were of course the Lamrim Tempo and the, you know, and especially how he clarified so much about emptiness. Because there was a lot of confusion in Tibet at the time he lived. Many people had fallen to the side of nihilism. You know how in his prayer that on the three principal aspects of the path, we talks about the two extremes. So one was absolutism, that's what the extreme people were in at the time of Nagarjuna. And then at the time of Jay Rinpoche, many of the Tibetans had gone to the side of nihilism, you know, saying that emptiness, you know, didn't exist, or emptiness was, inherently existent, or, you know, many, many wrong conceptions. And so he really refuted those wrong conceptions and established very clearly, you know, the middle way path. And when you study his text, you really see, you know, what genius was involved in doing this. You know, of how easy it is to go to one extreme or another, because our mind is always going from one to the other. You know, because we confuse existence with inherent existence and emptiness with non-existence. So we're always confusing those. And so we keep falling, you know, to absolutism and nihilism. So he really clarified that very fine line of how to walk. And he clarified many points on Tantra as well. You know, because there's always so much confusion in people's minds about how to practice both Sutra and Tantra. And if you don't have the correct view on how to do these things, you can do a lot of practice, but you don't get the right results. Yeah. And then he started the three great monasteries, the three seats, Sera, Drepung, and Ganden, which became the largest monasteries in the world, at least Drepung was at one point, you know, before 1959, had over 10,000 monks in it. It's quite remarkable when you think about it. So just, you know, reviving the monastic tradition, and, you know, because the monastic tradition in Tibet had gone up and down and up and down many, many times, you know, but he really valued it as the foundation for practice, and so set it up quite strongly. And the monasteries really, really thrived until 1959, and then, of course, they were destroyed and they were re-arose in India. When Jay Rinpoche passed away, the first monastery he began was Ganden, which was outside of Lhasa, about an hour and a half by bus outside of Lhasa. And it was up on this mountain. And when he passed away, they built a stupa around him. And at some point, the communists made the Tibetans desecrate the stupa and take out his body. And they found his hands were like this, crossed like this, and his fingernails had still been growing and were wrapped around his body. His hair had still been growing. Remarkable. I don't know what happened after that. Anybody heard? What happened? But he left to us, you know, such a vibrant tradition that's come down through the centuries, that, you know, has reached our ears. So we're really, it is the fortunate ones, to be able to hear Jay Rinpoche's teachings. And just see by his life example, you know, I mean, it really impressed me how he's totally non-sectarian and studied with the great masters, how he really was not content with a little bit of information, but really thought about the teachings quite seriously and in depth, how he was not just someone who intellectually knew the teachings, but actually practiced, beginning with the foundation practices of prostrations and mandala offerings and stuff, you know. So he didn't just say, okay, I can see Manjushri, I don't need to do the rest of this stuff. Yeah, he did it all. He took eight of his disciples with him and he did it. Fortunate disciple. They probably didn't sleep much. just his life was a tremendous example for us. And also another way I think that his life was an example was he was, you know, there's different ways of explaining. Some people say he was, you know, he attained Buddhahood. Some people say he was at the path of seeing or one of the other paths. So there's different ways of explanation. But in any case, whatever it was, and there's one way of explaining that he, you know, had attained at least the path of seeing. And in Tantra was, you know, a fit disciple to do consort practice. And if he had done consort practice in that life, he would have attained Buddhahood in that very life. But because he had such regard and respect for the monastic tradition, and he was a monk, and he didn't want future generations of people to get the wrong idea, therefore, he kept his monastic vows purely. He did not do consort practice, and instead, he attained enlightenment in the Bardo. Yeah. So it said that that's also one of his great kindnesses, because he postponed his own enlightenment so that we, you know, the stupid people in future generations who want to have samsara and nirvana together, would get the message that, no, it's incredibly important to keep one's monastic vows purely and well. Okay, so I have tremendous respect for Jay Rinpoche. And, you know, at the beginning of my practice, you know, it's like I just heard Lam Rin and I didn't even know who Lamson Kapa was very much. And, okay, yeah, I guess the guy who wrote this was good, you know. But then as you study the Lam Rin more and more, and especially when you get into his explanations on emptiness, you know, and they're not easy to understand, but he, you know, but they're not easy to understand because you keep falling off to the two extremes. You know, I think when you get it, it's probably pretty easy. But you know, the more I study his text, the more my respect for his incredible kindness and his realizations increases. And so I think this happens kind of automatically. You know, you have the fortune to study the texts of some of the masters, that you begin then to really see their greatness, because the texts have a very strong impact on one's own mind. There's one other story about Jay that I like. When you know, when you do the visualization of Jay Rinpoche, you know, it's Jay Rinpoche and then his two disciples, Gyaltsen Jay and Kedrupche. So Gyaltsen Jay was an older monk at the time Jay Rinpoche lived, and he heard about this young upstart, you know, Tsongkhapa, who, you know, was giving these teachings, and Gyaltsen Jay go, yeah, you know, we know all about these young upstarts that everybody raves about. So, but, you know, he was in the area, so he went to one Jay Rinpoche was teaching. So, of course, you know, the teacher always sits higher and the disciples are on the floor. Well, Gyaltsen Jay, he wasn't going to sit on the floor, you know, with some young upstart teaching. So he sat on a seat that was the same height as Jay Rinpoche. And as Jay Rinpoche started to teach and teach and teach, then Gyaltsen Jay kind of quietly got up and sat on the floor. Because he, you know, began to realize that this was no, you know, kind of brash, arrogant young upstart. This was, you know, a highly realized being. And so he became, you know, he and Kedrupche became Jay Rinpoche's two chief disciples. And then I think the first Dalai Lama was also one of his disciples, isn't he? Okay. So this practice, it's a practice of guru yoga. Okay, so we're trying to unite our mind with Jay Rinpoche's mind. And not just with Jay Rinpoche as a historical figure, but really thinking of Jay Rinpoche's realizations and the realizations of our own spiritual teachers and the realizations of the Buddhas, all being the same, okay? So not differentiating the different forms that the vigorous omniscient mind appears to us in. Well, we differentiate on conventional level the different forms, but really seeing that the nature of inseparable bliss and wisdom is the same in all of them. So it's quite powerful when you do it as a guru yoga practice in that way. It's essentially a seven limb practice, if you look at it. The verses are in a little bit different order, okay? We start out, of course, with refuge and bodhicitta. So I want to explain that. And then the first verse is invoking them to come, okay? So it's from the heart of the Lord Protector of Tushita's 100 gods. So it's, you know, you visualize Tushita heaven, and Maitreya is sitting there. They say that Maitreya, that is going to be the next, you know, wheel-turning Buddha, is in Tushita. And from his heart, okay, comes a beam of light down from Maitreya's heart, comes this beam of light, and you have fluffy clouds piled up like fresh curd. I guess that's a visualization, Tibetan flight. okay, then sitting on top of this, you know, on the throne and lotus and sun and moon, is Jagan Pache, and his ordination name was Lobsangdrapa. Okay. So please come here with your spiritual children. That's with Gyaltsa Jain Kedra Jain. So they all appear sitting on the clouds, you know, the clouds of offerings. So this in the sky in before me on lion thrones with lotus and moon seats sit the holy gurus with beautiful smiling faces. Supreme field of merit for my mind of faith. Okay, so they're a field of merit that, which means that, you know, you usually grow things in field. Well, what we're trying to grow is merit, and how we do this is by doing the seven limb prayer and making offerings and so on, to Jay Rinpoche. So we're saying please stay for 100 eons to spread the teachings. Okay, so that second verse is actually the verse requesting the Guru and the Buddha to remain until samsara ends. Okay, so usually in other versions of the seven limb prayer, sometimes it's the fifth line, sometimes the sixth line. Here it's brought up right at the beginning. Okay, because you're invoking them and then asking them to remain. Okay, and then the next verse is prostrating. So first prostrating to his mind, the mind of pure genius that spans the whole range of knowledge, so that's omniscience. Then prostration to his speech, the speech of eloquence, jewel ornament for the fortunate ear. That means our ear is fortunate to hear. And then his body, the body of beauty, resplendent with the glory of faith. Then I bow to you, so beneficial to see, hear, and remember. Okay. So I think that's incredible. I mean, to you know, when we think about us, you know, would anybody say about us that it's beneficial to see, hear, and remember us? How do people usually think of us? You know, people usually think of us with attachment, with anger, with jealousy, you know, because we were either lording something over them or, you know, making fun of them or competing with them or, you know, because we didn't do so much that was so beneficial, then of course, you know, when they see, hear, and remember us, it's like, oh, you know, this person. But when you live your life like Jay Rinpoche did, it's like, so beneficial to see, hear, and remember. Wow, you know. I mean, what an inspiring thought. May I become like Jay Rinpoche so that, you know, when people see her, remember me, it actually benefits them. And so gives us a role model to aspire to be like. And then the next verse is making offerings, okay? So various delightful offerings, flowers, perfumes, insects, lights, pure and sweet waters, those actually presented, so the ones on the altar, and the ocean of offering clouds created by our imagination. So, like we do in the extensive offering practice, the whole sky filled with different things. So you can stop here and do the extensive offering practice at this point. Okay, and then the next verse is confession. Okay, so all our negativities committed with body, speech, and mind from the beginningless time. So we're not holding anything back. And then a special transgression of the three sets of vows. So the Prati Moksha vows, so that refers to either your lay precepts or, any of the monastic precepts, or the eight precepts that you've taken. So that's one set of vows, the Prati Mokshas. And then the second set is Bodhisattva vows, and the third set is the Tantric vows. Okay, so again, letting us know it's important to keep our vows as best as we can. Okay, so confessing them with strong regret from the depth of our heart. And then in this degenerate time, you work for broad learning and accomplishments, abandoning the eight worldly concerns to realize the great value of freedom and fortune. Okay, so the great value of freedom and fortune is the value of the precious human life. Okay, and abandoning the eight worldly concerns. Is that easy or not easy? Yeah? Not easy, is it? Not easy at all. The eight worldly concerns are really in there. And it said that one way, in which Jay Rinpoche abandoned the eight worldly concerns was he had been invited by the Chinese emperor to go to Beijing and teach, which of course was a great honor, and if you go there, you live it up, and you get lots of offerings, and you become quite famous, he turned it down. He thought it was better to stay and teach in Tibet rather than to go to Beijing. So he gave up the perks of the eight worldly concerns that he could have had by having the luxury of the Chinese court, and instead worked for broad learning and really deep spiritual accomplishments. So we're rejoicing in that. And that's also a real good example for us too, isn't it? Giving up the worldly concerns for the benefit of the Dharma. Okay, and then the next is requesting teachings, and to me, this is like one of the pithiest parts of the whole thing. It's funny, I never really resonated so much about the seven and third, the verse requesting teachings, until I went to Italy. Until that, I had been in Nepal and India, and there were plenty of teachings around and plenty of teachers. And then I was shipped out to Italy, and when I first went there, there was no teacher living at the center. And so I really saw, I need to do this first. This is an important part of the seven limb prayer. I just can't take receiving teachings for granted, because here I am, and there's nobody around to teach me. So I really have to spend some time requesting and requesting and requesting and requesting, sincerely. So here we're requesting, so from the space of the Buddha's omniscient mind, the Dharmakaya, the truth body, So within that space, from the billowing clouds of wisdom and love, let fall the rain of the profound and extensive Dharma. Profound Dharma is the teachings on emptiness, the wisdom teachings, extensive, the teachings on bodhicitta, the method side of the path. And let fall the Dharma in whatever form is suitable for subduing sentient beings. And I think that has great meaning, because sentient beings have so many different dispositions, so many different inklings. One way of teaching fits one person, but it doesn't fit another person. One way of practice makes sense to one person, another person it doesn't. So to have that ability, and you really see the Buddha's skill as a teacher, and that's why there's so many Buddhist traditions, is because the Buddha gave so many teachings, because people have different interests, different dispositions. So I think that's the skill of a really great teacher, to be able to teach according to the faculties and the interests of the particular disciples. Okay. So really teaching in whatever form is suitable for subduing sentient being. So in saying this, we're not just, you know, okay, teacher, teach me, and these are the teachings I want. Okay? But it's like for the benefit of all these sentient beings, some of which have to learn all these other different practices and paths beforehand, you know, please teach whatever anybody needs at this particular moment that's going to enable them to live a life of virtue and create good karma, so that slowly and gradually their view can be refined until they get the correct view. Mm-hmm. So I think that has great meaning and really a tribute to the Buddha, okay, to teach in that way. You know, and it's also saying to us why we should never criticize any other Buddhist tradition, because it all came from the Buddha. Okay? It's fine to debate, it's fine to discuss, you know, but we should never criticize, you know, because the Buddha taught different things for different people. So just because something doesn't fit us, it might be very helpful to somebody else, and that's good. And then the next verse is the dedication. Okay? So the essence of the Buddhist doctrine and the teachings of Venerable Losang Drapa shine for a long time. Okay, so you have the seven-room prayer there, then you have the mandala offering. And then you, if you're doing, one way to do the Guru Yoga practice is to recite 100,000 Nidsemas. Nidsemas is the name of the request verse to Jay Rinpoche. Actually, this verse he originally wrote for one of his teachers. Was it Lama Umapa?
Rindawa,
that's right. So he wrote it for Rindawa. And then they were student and teacher to each other. So Lama Rindawa said, no, actually I have to offer it back to you, and so substituted Losang Drapa in there, you know, for his name, and offered it back to Jay Rinpoche. And it was very interesting, two people being student and teachers to each other. It's like His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Senshi Sekhar Rinpoche, the previous one. They were student and teacher to each other. You know, so you sometimes find that happening. Okay, so then in the request, usually when people do 100,000, they do the four-line one. We all want to do the shortest thing possible, don't we? So then it's the first, second, fourth, and fifth line here. But I think that, I mean, the request is, I think, quite profound. No, because it's saying that Jay Rinpoche is an emanation of Chenrezig, Manjushri, and Vajrapani, which are the chief, you know, bodhisattvas that represent the chief qualities of the Buddha. Chenrezig representing the Buddha's compassion, bodhicitta, Manjushri, wisdom, and then Vajrapani, the power or the skillful means of the Buddha. Okay? So actually, you know, when you start out, midnight sangha, I mean, just those four syllables, kind of, when you think about it, you could study the meaning of those four syllables for like, I don't know how many years, okay? Because midnight means without object. So what it means is without an inherently existent object. So there you have all the wisdom teachings, okay? Seiwei is compassion. Yeah. So the compassion that is without an inherently existing object. The someone who's able to have compassion without grasping at truly existent sentient beings. Okay? Yeah. Someone who's able to have compassion because he sees that sentient beings suffering is is not a given, that it's optional, because things are not inherently existent and that ignorance can be removed. Okay, so just, you know, midnight segue, that kind of compassion that sees without grasping an inherently personal object. Very profound. I mean, that's, you know, method of wisdom in the path, isn't it? And then Drime Kenpe, you know, you're talking about Drime here it's flawless, it can be like stainless, and Kenpe wisdom. Wangho is powerful, and then Jampe Yang is Manjushi. Okay, so that kind of flawless wisdom that doesn't fall to either of the extremes. You know, that isn't intellectual wisdom, but actual experiential wisdom, the meditation. And then Vajrapani, destroyer of all demonic forces, like self-centered thought and self-grasping ignorance. And then Sankhava, crown jewel of the snowy land sages. Okay, so snowy land referred to Tibet, but we get some snow here too. Happened to melt by today, but this is also a snowy land, so may we invite Lama Tsongkhapa here. And then Lo Tsongkhapa again, that's his ordination name. I make request to get ready. And then while you're, you know, reciting that, then there's all the visualizations that are described in Pearl of Wisdom on page 34 and 35. So you can read those and I think I'll go over them. But, you know, you can do one visualization in one session, one in another, however you want to do it. And then we make the special requests after, you know, reciting the Mitsena as many times as we want to. And then the absorption. So in the first verse, Jirimcha comes to the crown of our head. The second absorption verse, he comes into our heart. And there we grant me the general and sublime realizations. General realizations are the various psychic powers that are general to beings who have samadhi. And sublime realizations are the real unique realizations of somebody, you know, on the Buddhist path, the insight into emptiness and so forth. And then with the third verse, we had imagined a lotus in our heart, and please remain firmly until I attain enlightenment. Then that lotus kind of comes, and Jirimcha has descended into our heart, comes and the closes above, yeah, looking kind of like a drop of Jirimcha on the inside. And then we dedicate. That's just a little overview of it, but maybe something that will help you when you're doing practice. Okay.